We know our piper Rory Sinclair. We've heard him pipe here many times. Rory is a Renaissance man. He is the piper to the Earl of Caithness, the clan chief of Clan Sinclair, and he is my friend. I write things a lot, and he writes things on occasion, and he sent me an email this week saying, I wrote this. It came very fast, maybe 10 minutes, so fast, in fact, that it feels like I didn't have much of a hand in it. Happens that way sometimes. This is what he wrote. It seemed like a good start for Sunday's remarks. He came one day as one unknown to the family. He asked no favor, but that he sojourn for a short time. He listened closely and held his counsel. He spoke sparingly, but with power. He listened to the many as well as the few. He said, I see a family rent by woe, an unnecessary woe brought on by mistrust and fear, replacing the things you used to rely on, who you are to each other in the world. You breathe in the beneficence of the clan of nature, just as you breathe in the air. Know this, the Lord's blessing is like sweet honey in the stony rock. It can be found in the most unexpected places, and none comes so powerfully and profoundly as from the one unnoticed stranger. Labor's love found. We are distant strangers from the biblical text, and even more from the biblical characters and the real lives they may have lived beneath the text. We share a common humanity with them and a range of common feelings, and we recognize them in the things that have been written. But we explore them across two very different time periods as if there were a piece of plate glass in between us. And by the time you read about Jesus in Mark's gospel, you're already plumbing several layers of experience. There is a competition for hearts going on, and the range of religious response is being tested. Liberals and conservatives are at loggerheads then as now. And both of them are pulling out their books of photos and their sacred texts and shouting to each other, look at this, can't you see? Can't you see? Can't you see? The liberal outlook on life, and someone was very helpful in saying that liberal could be called liberating, and conservative could be called conserving. That's a different way of looking at it. It gentles a bit. But the liberal outlook on life sounds like as if God were inclusive, about freedom, about imagination, transformation, a broad acceptance of people just where you find them, and less need to control the social agenda. The text that goes with it would be, the wind blows where it will. We are children of the wind. God blows in us where God will. In the prophetic voices and in the New Testament, there is often heard a liberal leaning in the text. Help to the needy is more valuable than political correctness, they say. And the flow of life seems more genuine than any writing down of memories about the flow of life. It's better to be there and to do it. Now, the liberal stereotype of the conservatives is pretty nasty, as we know. This is also biblical. I'm not making this up. Small-minded, inauthentic, brittle, hateful, corrupt, self-serving, heavy-handed, not concerned about the misery of others. I'm enjoying this, by the way. Keeping control of the social agenda for their own tight little ends. Scribes and Pharisees, say the New Testament texts, are the fly in the ointment of a gracious God. Now that's a little one-sided, perhaps, hearing scribes and Pharisees and swear words gathered up in the same paragraph. In reality, the scribes were an honored profession. The scribes were the doctors of the law. I remember when our class completed our Doctor of Ministry degrees, our supervisor took us aside, sat us around a table, and said to us very seriously, When you graduate, you will become doctors of the church. You will be doctors of the church. And there was a profound sense of responsibility around the room. So the scribes were leaders, along with the high priests and the elders, in the highest echelons of Jewish power. They pored over the richness of Judaism to hold the tiller in terribly turbulent times. The scribes were gifted. Real scribes may have been more curious about Jesus than critical of Jesus, because intelligence often warms to the intelligence it finds in another. Pharisees are also given a bad rap in Mark's texts. The Pharisees arose in a time when temple worship was truncated or torn apart altogether. Pharisees interpreted the Jewish law and customs to their own people right in the streets. They separated themselves from the rest of the culture to do it, and they paid a great price in the process. The Pharisees were the veterans of ideological wars, and to our surprise, they were liberal in their outlook, forward-thinking, seeking deeper things underneath the surface traditions they were given. They believed in the resurrection. They believed in a future world. They believed in ultimate reward and punishment. They believed in angels and final messianic deliverance. Indeed, Jesus and the Pharisees had a lot in common. If Jesus were truly a conversationalist and spent time with a variety of people, he surely would have taken time to sit down with the scribes and the Pharisees and talk to them. After all, Mark tells us this is a delegation of officials from Jerusalem. I have a feeling here that Mark is writing about his own time and his own church and placing it back into the life of Jesus. I think that by the time Mark's church was up and running, delegations from Jerusalem were coming to find out what this new movement was about. So Jesus might well ask, "What is it you're seeing in my work that is so alarmingly offensive?" And then he would listen. He would listen to respond, not listen to argue. "You are untrained," they would say, "no credentials. Your style is loose, and you're casting your net too wide. You meet people just where they are, and you welcome them. And this is a threat to moral accountability and communal responsibility. You seem to refuse to practice the common shared civilities that make us who we are. You eat what you like, where and when you like. You cross the line to sit with Samaritans and Gentiles. You include women in your movement. You speak sacred words to people with unclean hands. If these things are not upheld," they said, "something ancient and beautiful and respectful is going to be lost." God is known in the tribe," they said. "God is known in the tribe, in the system, in the hierarchy. God is known by obeying the teachings, by moral living. And we, from Jerusalem, are the accepted teachers." And I can hear Jesus saying, "I can hear your point. And I really do respect your sincerity in holding it. I can hear that from the Lord of life. Writers will say of me later," he said, "that I attended synagogue on a regular basis, that I read from the Torah, that I even sat at the feet of saints in my childhood. My whole life story is going to be framed with the great story of the tribes of Israel. People will tell of me and think of you," said Jesus to them. Sometimes life gets up and smacks you right in the face. I was thinking about attitudes we hold the other day, and I had a presumption about them, which is wrong. I realized for the first time that anybody who really takes time and effort to think something through and to consider it deeply enough really ends up believing it. The person actually believes that his or her position is true. Now, that's a strange thing to say, but I often thought that people with crummy positions were intentionally lying to themselves and to me. Not so. I think if you worked hard at coming to a position, you actually believe it's true. So scribes and Pharisees and liberals and conservatives and secularists and evangelicals all believe that they are true. They believe that the way they see the world is the way the world is, and they expect the rest of us to get with the program and to fall into line. Indeed, they wring their hands and tear out their hair all across the spectrum, saying, why can't the rest of the people get the truth that we see so clearly? It happens across the spectrum. Now, I do that too. I feel I know how the world is supposed to work. Is that a little arrogant? I hope it isn't. I mean, I've been digging at the mystery as of you for a whole lifetime. I have a feeling about the way the world is supposed to work. Kindness and generosity and curiosity and patience and being in favor of love and peace and showing justice in action and tenderness in affection and helpfulness in demeanor and hopefulness for eternal life. There it is. That's the way a human life is to be lived. And I cannot see for the life of me why millions of people refuse to see it as clearly as I do. And I tear out my hair and I wring my hands as well. So in Mark, there is a simple impasse, and we're living in the same impasse more and more each day in North America and in the broader world. Openness versus restriction, support versus attack, wild versus tame, risk versus entrenched protectionism. Jesus says, when I was a boy, I loved my village and my family. I couldn't get enough of it. My mother would have to call me in 3 or 4 times of an evening because I loved simply to sit in the doorway and watch the heartbeat of my village walk by the door. I loved my father's ways. I sensed my own place in the broader tribe. Even as a child, you could taste it. And I feared what was generally feared, and I praised what was generally praised, the way a child will. And I was a loyal village Jew all my growing life. And then, somewhere, I became a lover of a mystery. The way the seasons roll, the way the sea gives us bounty or leaves us wanting, the way a mother mourns her dead child, the way a father takes the abuse from the overlord and does it with such quiet dignity and grace. I heard a God speaking to me through the whispers of the great texts that were read in the synagogues on a Sabbath. Now, later on, someone's going to take up a pen and write in my name, said Jesus, someone who will be known as James. The name means Jacob, which is the great founding father of Israel. He will be advising the people in the letter in the New Testament, and he's going to sound conservative. He's going to say we have to affirm heavenly things, and we have to push away earthly things. We're to listen for angels. We're refusing to listen to the ways of the flesh. It's about praying, not playfulness. It's about sanctification, not stimulation, he will write. And James is going to play on our guilt a little bit. He's going to set up impossible goals for us and then tell us that we can't possibly achieve them. You're not bright enough. You're not disciplined enough. You're not good enough. You're not worthy enough. All that stuff. We're fickle. We're flawed. We're weak. We're insecure. We don't need James to tell us that. We tell that to ourselves every morning looking in the mirror on the bad days, and other people hint it about us as we walk through the world. And it's all true to some extent. We all have our bad days. We all have days that are awful and disconnected. But that doesn't mean that our nature is bad and that our experience in the world is bad, because this world is the only template. This world is the only canvas on which we will paint our masterpiece. Jesus might have said, I have seen the face of God in a madman among the tombs, and I have seen the face of God in a leper begging by the roadside, and I've seen the face of God in a disabled person sitting by a sacred pool, and in the joy of one repentant tax collector and in the shining response of a once-dead girl. All these things happened in my experience on the very streets where we live, and they are profoundly real and life-changing, he would say. This life is blessed. We don't need to hide in the systems we make. Life itself will be our teacher, he would say. Now, this James, this new Jacob, will also write what true religion is. It is to care for the widow and the orphan. And I'm feeling that underneath all the other things James writes, that's getting pretty close to the bone. Perhaps one of the scribes might then say, and I'm just imagining this, I've often wondered if our texts are enough to hold the mystery. And the others would say, wait a minute, hold it. That's a chink in the arm, don't go there. No, I'm thinking, is there a whole language of feelings and experiences that are lost to us when we write the text down? Do we miss it by simply writing the text, he would say? And then a Pharisee listening in might pipe up and say, I have an inner life, you know. I have a life beyond my community work and the rituals that I practice every day. I'm a person with needs and desires, and everyone gets a little squirmy. And I have fears and dreams. There's a secret child inside me living with bright eyes in the midst of my crusader's facade. And Jesus might well agree. He might say that everything we do is a response to something, and the something is often deeper than we know. It isn't the bird that fascinates us. It's the song in the bird. It's the colors of the wings of the bird. It's the miracle of flight in which he participates. It's the intricacy of the nest in which she raises her young. It is found in the deep wildness and throes of poetry, this mysterious thing. The thing the visionaries say without realizing it, in the wildness of poetry. And I'm thinking of the Song of Songs. I'm so glad the Song of Songs came up. I've never preached a sermon, even on the hem of the Song of Songs, but here it is, and here it comes. The Song of Songs is another way of saying the greatest song. This is the greatest song. It's such a hot potato, and it's such a threat to personal peace and public order that we've never known what to do with the Song of Songs. It is both old and contemporary. It is desperately intimate, and it is universal. Now, some have sloughed it off by calling it religious. Let's just call it religious. This is the human heart reaching out to the God who made us. Isn't that sweet? That's not what it is at all. It's secular. It's older. It's deeper. It's different. And some have called it a selection of King Solomon's seduction poetry. Well, it isn't that either. It's something more. It's a bombshell at the heart of life. It asks us, what are we going to do with the phosphorus fire that is burning inside each one of us? This poem is about sexuality, but it touches the heart. It is more than personal vulnerability, but there's nothing more personal than the subject matter of this poem. This is about our out-of-control, can't-help-myself bliss that we both long for and flee. We all carry fire like that inside us. Can you feel it? Do you know what I'm talking to you about this morning? Smeared by culture, it may be, tempered by moral restriction, shamed by the family, blunted by personal discomfort, but by God, it's there. Arise, my love, and come away. Life is sweet, and my soul hungers for the wonder of you. Let our passion and delight take us to places we've never been. Did I say that out loud? Did I say that out loud? I can see the scribes and the Pharisees shifting in their seats. Even Jesus may be blushing at the sound of such heartfelt things. This is the heart center of our lives, to be that open and free and vulnerable in somebody else's hands. It's both bliss and terror, is it not? The danger is that we are incomplete without it, and we bend our lives out of shape because of our incompleteness. We're jealous of other people's bliss, We're self-loathing because of our own disconnection. We're spiteful of joy. We're vengeful in our verbal assaults. Have you ever written or received a note like this, the antithesis of the poem? Go away, you vile creature, bane of my existence. Your winter is here. You deserve the rains that are soaking your skin. Funeral flowers abound for you. The stench of rotting weeds is yours. No glad songs, only scorn. Ravens and vultures around you. Infested fig trees and shriveled vines around you. Go away, you disgusting creature. Go away. How many of us have been blunted by such a letter? How many of us have borne the scars of such abuse all our lives? It's a denial of the fire in our souls. Now, I do not expect the intimate things of our lives to be public things, and I don't expect to have our deepest longings to be fodder for gossip and mockery. We are not articles in movie magazines, you and I. But until the poet speaks and this hidden but well-known layer of our lives is acknowledged and valued by us, life is diminished and religion becomes legalism and God becomes a critic and our desire for loving affection becomes a matter of hunting or being hunted for the sake of a conquest. But before this, deeper than this, there was a vision of the human heart meeting and listening and finding delight in another. Somewhere within us, labor found its love. Somewhere it sings its siren song to its lover across the back fence and waits for the heart response. Do not let go of that dream. Do not disparage it as false or foolish. It is real, it is yours. And to be in the intimate presence of God is like that.